And this morning comes from Luke chapter 6, verses 17 through 26. Jesus came down with them and stood on a level place with a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea, Jerusalem, and the coast of Tyre and Sidon. They had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases, and those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured. And all in the crowd were trying to touch him, for power came out from him and healed all of them. Then Jesus looked at his disciples and said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you will be filled. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you, when they exclude you and revile you and defame you on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice on that day and leap for joy, for surely your reward is great, for that is what their ancestors did to the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you will be hungry. Woe to you who are laughing now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when all speak well of you, for that is what their ancestors did to the false prophets." These are our sacred stories. When Christianity is manipulated into a religion that supports the dominant culture rather than resisting it, when Christianity is used to support violence, when it ceases to be a religion for the oppressed and becomes the religion of the oppressor, when it becomes not simply complicit but actively a part of a culture that teaches fear and distrust, when words of hate are hurled in the name of Christ, we are no longer practicing Christianity. Jesus says, "But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you will be hungry. Woe to you who are laughing now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when all speak well of you, for that is what their ancestors did of the false prophets." Jesus reserves his strongest criticism for those in power, for those who use their power to oppress. The blatant hypocrisy that calls LGBTQ plus people sinners while willfully doing nothing to stop known sexual predators is appalling. The church as a whole has participated in and even led in violence against the marginalized, against women, LGBTQ plus people, and people of color for centuries. Much of the church's power has been created and maintained through subjugation. God calls us to welcome and to love. God calls us to care for the poor and the oppressed. From God's delivering the Hebrew people out of slavery in Egypt to the prophets railing against injustice to the liberating life and teachings of Jesus, the Bible gives us clear and consistent messaging to care for the abused, the excluded, the oppressed. Following God means rejecting the abuse of the powerful. It means protecting the vulnerable. The church has for so long now been part of systemic exploitation. For too long, we've been responsible for perpetuating generations of abuse, patriarchy, and mistreatment. How we tell and interpret our sacred stories influences how we perceive God and how we treat each other. If we ignore the stories of rape, of sex trafficking, of abuse, we not only gloss over devastating experiences by survivors, but we lose the opportunity to demand justice and systems of abuse now. It's time to hear stories and to believe them. It's past time. Now is the time for people of faith to call out injustices and structures of exploitation and abuse. Religion has often treated sex as something to be feared, denied, exploited. It's been understood as a means of transferring sin. Surely some of the sexual violence that has been uncovered in the Catholic Church is connected to the doctrinal understandings of sex. Likewise, many churches in the Southern Baptist Convention have been unwilling to have an open and honest conversation about sex and sexuality. And this has no doubt contributed to the silence of survivors and the cover-up in leaders. I wish I could say that I was shocked when Liz Turner told me last Sunday about the article she read in that morning's Chronicle, the article entitled "Abuse of Faith, 20 Years, 700 Victims, Southern Baptist Sexual Abuse Spreads as Leaders Resist Reforms." I wish I could say I was shocked when I read the article myself that Sunday evening. I felt sick, but not surprised. I'm not sure any of us should be surprised. If we've learned anything from the thousands of survivors who've been willing to say, "Me too," we've learned that an epidemic of sexual violence permeates our entire society. As you know, I grew up Southern Baptist. I grew up attending churches with wonderful people who did their very best to love me and to show me God's love. I'm a preacher's kid. As a girl, it was made very clear to me that leadership in the church was not an acceptable path for women. My father, who was also my minister, did not hold with this view, but in the churches he pastored, there were no women in official leadership roles. And my Sunday school teachers and my camp pastors were firmly convinced that women should not be ministers. I, like other Southern Baptists and Baptists of any stripe, was taught to believe in the priesthood of the believer, that I could read the Bible for myself, that I did not need a priest to pray for me or to ask for forgiveness for me, the belief that I have direct access to God. I started reading the Bible, and what I found amazed me. Much of what I was being taught or handed as an unquestioned cultural norm was not biblical. For example, bumper stickers and sermonic shouts about biblical family values just won't hold up to the stories of the Bible. Which biblical family could preachers and pundits be referring to? Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar? That's a biblical family. Jacob, Leah, and Rachel, and at least two concubines. That's a biblical family. Solomon, with his 700 wives and 300 concubines. That's a biblical family. Cain killed his brother Abel. Joseph's brothers faked his death and then sold him into slavery. Jacob stole his brother Esau's inheritance, and then with help from their mother, he stole his blessing. Once, while Jesus was teaching, he was told that his mother and his siblings were waiting outside to speak with him. And Jesus, pointing to his disciples, Jesus said, "Here are my mother and my brothers, for whoever does the will of God is my mother and brother and sisters." Biblical families are not one man married to one woman with 2.5 well-behaved kids and a camel. And women in the Bible? Women in the Bible, unlike so many women in our churches, are not limited to organizing potluck dinners and vacation Bible school. Women are prophets and judges, leaders and deacons, preachers and apostles. Women are called by God and used by God throughout the Bible, and the fact that their stories are preserved amid centuries of patriarchy is nothing short of a miracle. What does this have to do with the rampant sexual abuse in the church? Everything. While people, almost always men, in power have been covering up sexual abuse for millennia, the Bible boldly records the tragic stories of survivors of sexual violence. When I read the Bible for myself, I discovered so many stories that never made it into Sunday school lessons, that were never the themes of tent revivals, that were never read on Sunday mornings. When we ignore and silence the stories of the survivors and the Bible, how much more are we willing to ignore and silence the survivors in our churches? If you grew up in church, no matter what denomination, I'm guessing that the stories of sexual violence in the Bible were not part of your religious education either. These stories matter. How we read them matters. That we read them matters. The Bible has many of what biblical scholar Phyllis Trible calls texts of terror, stories of what happens when the powerful become corrupt and the vulnerable are silenced. I don't expect you to take my word for it. Look up 2 Samuel 13 and read about the rape of Tamar, King David's son, and Tamar's half-brother, Amnon, attacks Tamar and rapes her. He's assisted by his advisor, Jonadab. Tamar, unlike so many women in the Bible, is given a voice, and with her voice she begs Amnon not to rape her. "No, my brother, do not force me," she cries, "for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do anything so vile. As for me, where could I carry my shame? Where could I carry my shame?" she cries. This is part of the problem. Not only do we not tell this story, but perhaps worse, it's recorded as Tamar's shame, the survivor's shame. Tamar tells her full brother, Absalom, about her rape, and he replies, "Be quiet now, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this to heart." This should sound familiar. This is the story in last week's article of Ed Young hanging up on the mother reporting her daughter's rape in Second Baptist Church's choir room by a church leader. This is the patriarchy in action, then and now. Read the rape of Dinah in Genesis 34. Read the rape of the concubine in Judges 19. Read again that story of the woman caught in adultery in John 8 and ask yourself why she's standing there alone, alone, with her neighbors ready to stone her. Read about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19 and be prepared to discover that Lot was willing to send out his own daughters to be raped by a marauding crowd. Read the story of King David's rape of Bathsheba in 2 Samuel 11. Read the book of Esther again. Esther was sex trafficked and raped. These stories are our stories, our sacred stories. These stories are resonant with the brave stories from actors and chefs, from school children and altar boys. We've heard from teenagers and youth group and grown-ups seeking counseling. We've heard from co-workers of news anchors and employees trying to climb the corporate ladder. We've heard from nuns and students on university campuses. Sexual violence is an epidemic in our country, and silence is no longer an option. We cannot continue to ignore what is happening, and we cannot close our mouths, our ears, our minds to the much-needed dialogue on sex and sexuality. We must resist the temptation to make this just about the Southern Baptists or the Catholics or the university campus or Hollywood. This is about all of us. It's about our culture's normalization of misogyny and heteronormativity, about our culture's normalization of unchecked power and the villainization of survivors. When we allow the culture to tell us that women are worth less than men, that LGBTQ plus people are of less value because of who they love, when we allow our culture to keep abusers in power, we all have a problem. When the first questions asked of those who've been raped is what they were wearing and if they'd been drinking, we all have a problem. When religion is used to protect the people in power rather than to empower the oppressed, we all have a problem. When power is more important than people, we have a problem. The church, regardless of denomination, has a lot to answer for. While exposing the devastating and pervasive problem of sexual violence in the church might be seen as a good reason to stay away from religion or spirituality, I hope we can instead see this as the moment of change. This is the moment to move away from systems of power and privilege, the systems that create the environments conducive to abuse. This is the moment to read again from our sacred stories and to see a God who is present with us in pain, a God who calls us to work for healing and wholeness. This is the moment to hear the stories that need to be shared and to honor the sacred courage it takes to speak. This is the moment for change. May we take heart and courage and do the change that must be done. Amen.